7:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly visit with one of Alaska's genuine old-timers, as brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company, operated by Joe Coble. And their telephone number, as you know by now, is East 108. And this week's visitor in the studio is Mr. Eustace Paul Ziegler, distinguished Alaskan painter. And Mr. Ziegler, I'd like to begin by asking you your age.
66.
66 years young, he says. And I wonder, what was your home in the States before your interests turned northward?
Detroit, Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the turning point to the North Country?
Well, I read a book that made Alaska very interesting to me by Lout and decided to go to Alaska to paint.
I see. What was the home in Alaska for you?
Cordova, Alaska.
Uh-huh. I'm interested in hearing some of your early day experiences in Cordova. I imagine you knew Bishop Rowe, didn't you?
Intimately.
Mm-hmm. What sort of an occupation did you have in Cordova? What did you do to...
I went up there to work for him and to run the Red Dragon Clubhouse, an institution which was very successful with a pool table and card playing and so forth for the men in that town, where there were 27 saloons and no other places other than that. So we ran this clubhouse there for these men during the construction of the Copper River Northwestern Railroad.
Now, Red Dragon, that would indicate something of the underworld. I wonder what sort of an organization that was.
The mission was called St. George's Mission of the Episcopal Church, and the symbol of St. George was the Red Dragon, and so they named this clubhouse after the symbol of St. George.
Mm-hmm. And that was in the railroad and copper days of the Copper River country in Cordova.
They were building the Copper River Northwestern into the Kennecott mines at that time.
I see. Now, will you tell me something of your acquaintance with Bishop Rowe? How long you knew him and what sort of a man he was?
Well, I've known him since 1909. He was an intimate friend of my father's and one of the great pioneers and characters of Alaska. And he was in charge of the Episcopal Church for nearly 50 years here.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bishop Rowe, as I understand it, spent considerable time in Cordova, and was he one of the critics of a picture or a mural that you did for a theater in Cordova at
one
time?
He didn't spend much time in Cordova. He came up there once a year, fortunately for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had this, when Captain Lathrop built the first theater that he did build in Cordova, I was requested to paint a mural decoration in a cubicle over the main room. And do you want me to go ahead with the story?
Yes, please.
And so
do.
We went ahead, and I did my first mural decoration there, and I painted some semi-nudes in this picture. There was a rival organization there that didn't approve of this. Go ahead on this.
Oh, good.
And so I went ahead with this picture, and these rival organization, after the bishop asked me to go to the theater that night, circled around us to see what he had to say about that, and hoping that I would be pushed out. The bishop put his arm around me and said, "My boy," he said, "they're just beautiful."
He approved completely then. I'm interested in your acquaintance with Captain Lathrop in Cordova. I suppose you've known him for a good many years then.
Since 1909.
Mm-hmm. And that was when he was making his beginning in the coastal town. I wonder if there are some other features of life in Cordova that you'd like to recall in connection with Captain Lathrop. I suppose that you knew him pretty well at that time, or have you known him better in later years?
I've known him consistently right straight through. I wouldn't say we were intimate, but he was interested in my family in particularly and has always been very kind, and I've always considered myself an intimate friend of his.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Ziegler, bringing the time right up to 1947, wasn't Captain Lathrop approached in regard to a painting of yours in New York?
Yes, an interesting affair. A good many years ago, I went into McKinley Park. It was almost before it was a park, and I spent 12 weeks in there painting a certain picture. And a Robert Mainzer, a partner of Halgarten and Company in New York, had heard of this painting, and he decided to see it and purchase it in Seattle if he could. And so he came to my studio in Seattle and asked to see this picture and purchased it for $500. He asked me if I was married. I said, yes. He said, will you and your wife come to dinner with us at the Olympic tonight? And I said, I'd be delighted. He said, have you a dress suit? I said, I have. He said, don't wear it. He paid me for the picture and the last I saw of him. While I was on this visit, partially as a guest of Captain Lathrop. He received a letter from a New York dealer on 51st Street, New York, who had this picture on exhibition, and he wished to sell it to Captain Lathrop for $2,500. How it got into the possession of this dealer, I do not know. But, of course, as far as selling pictures to Cap Lathrop's concerned, he doesn't buy my pictures. Cap can have my paintings.
Now, if I were Cap, I would have thought that that was a put-up job.
I thought so, too, and so I wrote a letter at once to that dealer and showed it to Cap's secretary, telling him that we had never had any intercourse previous to this.
I see. So things finally worked out all right, and I suppose
Perfectly
Cap
Perfectly satisfactory. Cap never suspected me in the first place.
You know, one of your pictures, which is quite well known, I understand, is the picture called Assessment Work. Would you mind giving us the background on that picture?
I was asked to become a member of a party who went to do some assessment work in the Copper River Valley. Well, the business of these men who went on this assessment work was sheep hunting, painting pictures, and playing cards. So we went in there, and we had several days of rain. While we were sitting there, I painted the pictures of my partners sitting there playing cards. They had an old candlestick stuck in the top of a beer bottle, and the old socks were hanging on a wire over the table and a dog under the table. And I finished this picture, and finally the leader came, and he said, "Zig," he said, "that's a great picture," he said. "I have just the title for it." "What is it, Vin?" "Doing the assessment work." I think I've sold 15 of them since.
Is that right? I wonder if you are well acquainted with other Alaskan artists. For example, one in this locality is Ted Lambert.
We're intimately acquainted. I'd never call Ted Lambert a pupil of mine. I'd call him an associate, although he came down to study with me for a couple of years. We've been on a good many trips in Alaska. I've suffered on those trips a great deal more than Lambert has. I don't like to travel with him. I have to when I go traveling. I went down the whole length of the Yukon with Lambert. I wish I had the sincerity of this fellow. This fellow is a comer in Alaska. He's a sincere painter and a great painter, and I don't like to say that the people of Fairbanks haven't an appreciation of the value of this man's work. I'm jealous and envious of Lambert's work.
Well, I think that certainly is saying a lot. Mr. Ziegler, you say that you've traveled with Lambert in Alaska. I wonder if you'd mind recalling the story of the birches and the phonograph.
We got to the birches on the Yukon, and Lambert said, "Come here, Zig. I wish to show you something." A couple of years previous, I was in Seattle when Lambert came down there to do some work for Lathrop. During the course of the conversation, he told me of a story when he was on the banks of the Yukon and his dogs had tried to get up a certain bank. They'd been 2 or 3 days without food at that time. When Lambert says he suffered in Alaska, he has. He's done the work and has suffered. So they started up this bank. He decided to let the dogs run up there, and they came to a cabin. The snow had brushed into the half-open door of this cabin. He swept it out. He had tied his dogs up, and they went in there, and he heard a groan in the next room. It startled him. His morale was low. He had been suffering for 2 or 3 days. So he went out and grabbed his rifle, and he went in there. He had started a fire. As soon as the fire warmed up, he heard this groan again. He went in the next room with his flashlight and found an old phonograph had come to life, which the lubrication had been melted by the heat of this new stove, and the ghost had disappeared.
And that was the explanation of the phonograph and the birches.
That was the explanation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to bring things up to the present again and talk about Alaska and art. How does Alaska rate in appreciation of art compared with Seattle, for example?
I don't think there's any city in the world where the appreciation of art is greater than of such a place as Fairbanks or Anchorage. I gave an exhibition shortly before I came up here a month ago, and I had 40 pictures in this exhibition, and it was a wonderful success at the Seattle Art Institute. The success consisted of having sold 4 paintings. It was written up with a full page in the Seattle magazine section of the Seattle Times. I came to Fairbanks and gave a preview at the club, and the first night I sold 27 paintings and took orders for 27 others.
Well, that certainly is interesting. In regard to Seattle, I understand that you've won a number of awards down there in the Pacific Northwest.
I won the Baker Award, the first, which is only given once. I've also won 6 times the popular award.
Well, that certainly is a lot to your credit, Mr. Ziegler, and I know that your paintings are certainly appreciated here in Alaska. I forgot to ask you, in mentioning the Alaskan artists, about Rusty Hurleen. Are you acquainted with Rusty?
I'm very well acquainted with Rusty Hurleen. I wish I were as magnanimous a chap as he is. When I went into Anchorage at his field 5 years ago, he greeted me with open hands, helped me hang my pictures, and I had nothing but courtesy from him, and I envy Rusty's gift and sincerity.
How about George Augapuk? That's something that interests all of us because George was here in Fairbanks for the carnival last year.
Lambert and Rusty and I will never reach the heights that George Augapuk has already reached. He'll probably be Alaska's outstanding artist for many years to come.
Is that right? Now, I'd wonder, too, about your interest in coming to Alaska. Do you come up here to paint or to sell?
I come up for both. People in Seattle imagine that I make my living in Seattle. I probably make 3/4 of my living from Alaska. But my whole background as a painter, you might say, for the last 40 years has been Alaska, and the only thing I am familiar with is the paintings of Alaska, and I love it from a sentimental standpoint.
Now, from the painting standpoint, what is it in Alaska of her geographical features that attracts you most? Would that be Mount McKinley?
In all probability, but I've always had a very great sentiment for the Copper River Valley, where I spent 16 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering where you are going after you leave Fairbanks. I understand you're leaving in a few days.
Well, I expect to go to Seattle, and then I'm going over in the Cascades and paint the fall foliage.
We hope that you'll be coming back to Fairbanks very soon. When will that be?
Probably next year, if the reception is anything such as I've had this time, which I couldn't ask for anything greater.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you ever so much, Mr. Ziegler. I've certainly enjoyed having a few minutes of reviewing your connections with Alaska, just as we have always enjoyed your paintings of the territory. Friends, you've listened to an interview with Mr. Eustace P. Ziegler, and this has been the program Here's a Pioneer, brought to you each week, each Wednesday evening at 7:30 by the Pioneer Cab Company. Seven:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a regular presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, operated by Joe Coble, and the telephone number is East 10A with a stand located opposite the Nordale Hotel. Now, we have as a distinguished pioneer of Alaska this week, Mr. George Parks, former governor of the territory. Mr. Parks, I'd like to begin by asking you, what brings you to Fairbanks at this time?
In connection with my regular work surveying the public lands, particularly at this time in connection surveying tracts along the Alaska Highway.
Now, where is your home in the territory, Mr. Parks?
Juneau.
Do you think Juneau is your favorite town in the territory, or would that be putting you on the spot?
I wouldn't say that, because I've lived in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Seward, and I like them all.
Mm-hmm. What was the date that you first set foot in the territory?
Early in 1907.
1907 was the date for you. Then this is your 40th year in Alaska.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Where were you originally from, and what were some of the circumstances that made you decide to come north?
Well, I was born in Denver, Colorado, and I attended the public schools in Denver and graduated from the Colorado School of Mines. After graduation, I was employed by an English company on mine examination work in Mexico, Arizona, and other places. And after returning from a trip to Mexico, the company had work in Alaska, and I was sent up from there, first entering through Ketchikan and Skagway.
Did Alaska appeal to you right from the first?
From the very first. Mm-hmm.
Did you do very much traveling there in behalf of the London Company on that first trip?
Traveled up from Skagway over the White Pass and Yukon Railroad to a point on Lake Windy Arm, and later on over as far as Klamani Lake. Matter of fact, we drove a buckboard from White Horse to Klamani Lake in 1907.
It is my understanding then, Mr. Parks, that after that you went outside and then returned rather soon, isn't that right?
I was out for a little less than a year, and the opportunity was offered to me by the government to come back here and working in mineral lands, classification of mineral lands, and I returned immediately.
I suppose a permanent home in Alaska appealed to you at that time.
It did.
And it still does.
Still does.
Mm-hmm. Now, when were you first in politics? That's what interests me.
I never was in politics.
Oh? How could that be? You were governor of the territory of Alaska?
Well, through my connections with the work of the department in Washington, I was in Washington on an official trip when I was offered the position as governor.
How many years were you governor of Alaska?
From 1925 to 1933.
And who was the president who appointed you?
President Coolidge.
President Coolidge. Now, I can think of many questions I would like to ask you about Alaska in those days. You know, people who have come up here in recent years and have been amazed at the comparative wealth and industrial and economic activity of the territory have wondered if Alaska ever did really endure any slack times. How about Alaska during the Depression years, 1929 and 30, when things were really tough in some places in the states?
Well, things were not too good here either, but I think we never suffered as much of a depression individually as they did outside.
There was certainly no great deal of poverty in Alaska at any time during your memory, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. How about the fishing industry? Did it go along just about the same as ever?
About the same, or it fluctuated according to the runs.
Did the mines operate? How about the price of gold during the Depression?
Well, that remained the same. There was no change.
No change in the price of gold, and so the mines were able to operate.
They were operating.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular unemployment up here?
Not that I recall. Mm-hmm.
I wonder about the cities of Alaska in those days. What were the largest cities of the territory, and how have they changed in recent years?
Well, I presume that when I first came here, that Fairbanks probably had the largest population.
Is that right? That surprises me.
I
would have thought
sure
that Ketchikan and Juneau would have been the leaders at that time. Anchorage has been the one to surprise everyone, hasn't it?
Anchorage has.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and that has been due to federal interest in the Anchorage area. Now,
the railroad, of course, influenced that, the construction of railroad.
That's right.
That started Anchorage off.
I can understand that, yes. Now, it occurs to me, too, that one of the big things for Alaska that certainly saw its fruition in your time as governor of the territory was aviation. Can you tell us something of the early development of aviation in the territory? Did you foresee such possibilities as it has achieved now?
We did not, definitely. Although I think some of the early flyers, like Joe Crossan and Bennett and Ben Eielson, visioned what we have today, perhaps. But during our time, there were no federal funds for construction of aviation fields. And the territory put up all the money that was actually spent, and the communities throughout the territory who appreciated the advantages of the quick communication, quick transportation, would furnish help and labor. The territory would furnish equipment and the necessary expenses, and that way many small communities developed their own fields.
Oh, I see. It was just a case of having a community picnic on Sunday and bring the shovel and axe and we'll have a good time and make an airfield.
A lot of the time. I think that every man, woman, and child in some of the villages contributed a certain amount of day's labor to the construction of the fields.
You know, Mr. Parks, I envy you for having seen and probably flown in a lot of the old crates that those boys were pushing around the territory there in the early days. Were they, in some cases, open cockpit jobs?
The first ones were all open cockpits.
Mm-hmm. Did you make many flights with them personally?
Yes, indeed. I flew a great deal with all those early pilots.
Can you recall some of the earliest flights that you made that really made an impression, that is, that proved the difference between the speed of the dog team and the airplane?
Well, I think the first long flight that I made started from Fairbanks and flew to Iditarod, from Iditarod to Unalakleet, from Unalakleet to the Nome, from Nome to Kotzebue, and from Kotzebue to Nulato, from Nulato to Koyukuk, and from Koyukuk to Fort Yukon, and from there to Circle Springs and from Circle Springs to Fairbanks. And we were, I think, something like 7 or 8 days on a trip like that, and you couldn't make it to the dog team in several years.
7 or 8 months. Well, I imagine that really did make an impression on you then. In all the time that you've spent in the territory, I'm sure there are a lot of us would like to know about the coldest temperature. When did you find the mercury at the most uncomfortable stage in all the time that you've been up here in Alaska?
I think the coldest temperature I ever experienced was in Fairbanks in 1916-17. As I recall it, when I arrived in Fairbanks, it was about 68 below.
68 degrees below zero. And I suppose your job in those days took you around a lot of places where you did not have the convenience of air transportation, and so it was rather difficult in the wintertime. Did you travel a lot by dog team, Mr. Parks?
Quite a good deal.
You did. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what a man of your position would select as hobbies in the territory in all these years.
Well, hunting and fishing principally in the earlier years, and more recently, taking colored photographs. And in Juneau, where we have a real golf course, I play golf a good deal.
I see sinister implications in your mentioning a real golf course. Now, coming from Fairbanks and being interested in the Fairbanks Golf and Country Club, it was my understanding that we had the only golf course in the territory. Is that correct?
I think that's not correct. We had the first one in Juneau, and later on we built one in Anchorage. And now there's one in Fairbanks, I'm told, although I've tried my best to get someone to go out there, and they all shy off. Now, whether they're afraid that Juneau will carry off the honors, I don't know.
Well, I have no doubt that as soon as the program is over, you'll have an offer from some of the members there for a round of golf at Fairbanks Golf and Country Club, Mr. Parks. You mentioned that you were interested, too, in hunting and fishing. I wonder, on that subject, do you believe that the hunting is thinning out, that the opportunities for good hunting are gone?
They're not gone, but very definitely there's less game, and there has to be a more rigid enforcement of the game laws.
You would suggest now that the people of Alaska do some serious thinking about conservation then?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Also that they try to make the people who have guns realize that the game is not going to last forever if it's destroyed wantonly.
Having been a governor of the territory, your views in regard to the future of Alaska, too, are of particular interest to me and to our listeners, I'm sure. I wonder whether you think Alaska is really capable of supporting a good many more people.
Definitely, I do.
Do you believe that that should be done immediately, that the government should make such concessions that people in the states here in present years are encouraged to come to Alaska?
I think that the development has to be a gradual one and that all phases of our economic life have to be developed together.
Do you believe that some people in the States, veterans particularly, are being encouraged to come to Alaska to too much of a degree? Do you think that they should not be encouraged to come, for example, in farming? And
well, of course, I don't know what they're encouraged to do from the outside, but many of the men who come to my office and come to me personally and write to me do not have a proper conception of the difficulties that they're going to encounter, nor do they have a conception of how much money they should have in order to get by. They then come up here very badly equipped.
You seem to indicate, then, that on the outside there's a woeful lack of how to settle in Alaska and also information to lead you to the decision of whether or not you should come to the territory.
Among those with whom I've talked who have come that way, there has been. Mm-hmm. They have not appreciated what they were going to be up against when they arrived here.
Being interested in land development in Alaska, I suppose the development of roads goes along with that, and do you foresee a great development of our territorial highway system in the next few years?
Of course, the plans have been made for a very definite increase in the road mileage and a road system. Whether or not it's completed depends entirely, of course, on whether or not Congress will devote the sufficient funds for it. At the present time, there's a road has been projected from the Alaska Highway to 40 Mile. Quite a little stretch of that road has been completed.
Where would it leave the Alaska Highway?
About 12 miles east of Tok Junction.
About how many miles would it extend into the 40-mile country?
About 150 miles, I believe.
Is that right? Well, I imagine that would open up a great area which is served now only by air and river.
Yes.
Now, they're planning or are working on a road down to the Kenai Peninsula. Of course, that's out of my neighborhood. I'd like to know something about that.
Well, that's to develop the agricultural lands on the Kenai Peninsula, which has long been considered to be one of the better agricultural areas in Alaska. At the present time, the road is being constructed to connect with the road system that ultimately will connect it with Anchorage.
Oh, I see. Now, I would like to drive as a tourist to Mount McKinley National Park, but that's impossible. Now, do you think that I'll ever see the day when I can do that?
At the present time, they're engaged in making surveys from the Richardson Highway to the Alaska Railroad, which will come out somewhere around Windy and extend into the park in that direction. And definitely that will be a tourist road.
That is
in the surveys are being made.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds encouraging. Now, what about this road that we hear about in this locality all the time, the road to Chena Hot Springs? Is that a good possibility?
Well, I don't know, of course, whether or not funds will be available, but plans have been made for the construction of it, and throughout the years, ever since I can remember, as a matter of fact, we've been figuring and hoping for such a road.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you ever so much, Mr. Parks. You strike me as one who has been well satisfied with his 40 years in the territory. Do you ever intend to make your home in the States?
Never.
Never, never. All right, well, thank you ever so much for appearing here on Here's a Pioneer. Friends, you've listened to an interview with Mr. George Parks, former governor of the territory of Alaska. And as you know, the program Here's a Pioneer is brought to you each Wednesday evening at 7:30 by the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel, and the telephone number 24 hours a day is East 10A. Company East 10A, and their stand, you know, is located across from the Nordale Hotel. This week, we have as a genuine old-timer Mr. Pat Doherty of Richardson, Alaska. Mr. Doherty, how far back was it that you came to the Northland? What year?
In 1893, there was a panic, and I was in Butte City, and the mines shut down there. Panic was caused by the depreciation of silver.
That was in the state of Montana.
In Montana. Mm-hmm. And things were awful hard and very little work. And I had another young fellow, started out and went up to Fort McLeod, then to Calgary, then to Edmonton. And knocked around there for quite a long time. And then we got in with the Hudson Bay outfit going to Athabasca Landing and going down the Athabasca River to Chipewyan, down Slave River to Greater Slave Lake and around the coast on the left-hand side of the lake. It's a big lake.
Oh, yeah.
And down to where the Mackenzie runs out of the lake. Mm-hmm. And went down there, and there was a mission, a French mission, at Fort Liard. And they had a little steamboat with a wheel on each side. And we got in there and went back to that river and wintered up around Fort Liard and the nuts and everything, and prospected and hunted and trapped and one thing another for the winter, and drove team for the dog teams for the Hudson Bay Company to different posts.
Were you hauling their provisions then?
Well, they was trading with the Indians, and they would go around with tea and tobacco and stuff of that kind and deliver to the Indians and get their furs.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you found the Indians in that part of the country much different than those over here in Alaska.
Not much, not very little. There was a tribe they called the Dog Ribs. And the Hudson Bay Company, when they went in there first, they encouraged them to dry the moose meat and put it in brine and salt it. And they done that, and they had too much salt, and they all pretty near died with the scurvy. So you couldn't sell an Indian in through that country any salt.
They wouldn't touch it.
No.
Uh-huh.
No. Uh-huh.
Well, will you continue with your travels then?
Well, then following spring, the Hudson Bay Company baled their furs, just like you do hay, with the flesh side out. And I went with them, I and my partner, up the Nelson River, go up to the old Montney Trail. That's a trail that runs from the Nelson River to Fort St. John's. And Fort St. John's is in Peace River. And it's a distance about 200 and some odd or 300 miles between that. I don't know exactly the exact distance. But they got up there, and there was a bunch of little cayuses there to haul the furs across to Fort St. John's. And we went out with them and started across there, and we had a little difficulties. There's not much water there. It's a tableland and a lot of old stagnant lakes.
Oh, yes.
And geese and ducks and everything like that. And you can smell them about 5 or 6 miles before you come to them. And so we got over there, and we run short of grub, and we had to kill a horse and eat it before we got to Fort St. John's.
What kind of eating was that? Did you mind the horse?
Well, we just simply built a great big campfire and threw a side of the ribs on the campfire and fried it, and we didn't wait very long because we were all hungry. And it was very good at the time.
And at least you had the assurance that it was fresh meat.
Yeah, the fresh meat, yeah. Uh-huh. Then we got over to Fort St. John's and delivered our stuff, and there was a fellow by the name of Hamilton. He was a half-breed or a quarter-breed, and he had a big raft there, and they unloaded everything there and put it in the raft, and they started down the river, and we went back with a little bunch of horses again back to the Montney Trail where we started from, and then took the boats that were left there back down to Fort Liard. The Nelson River runs into the Liard River above Fort Liard. And we went down there, and then afterwards we knocked around that summer and winter prospecting and one thing and another, and next fall trapping and anything. And finally, in a short time, we went to the Peel River, up to Fort Nelson.
Oh, yes.
And then went up the Peel River, to the head up to Rat River, and crossed over the portage to the Porcupine, and down the Porcupine to Fort Yukon.
What was Fort Yukon like at that time?
Well, it was just a trading post, is all.
Do you recall what year it was that you first hit Fort Yukon?
Well, in 94.
1894.
Mm-hmm. About that time, or it was yes, in the fall of 94.
Did you stay there very long?
No, we didn't. We went back up the Porcupine ways, and we trapped there that winter, and then the next. When we come down, there was reports we stayed there for quite a while. We had lots of grub there. We got lots of grub. And we heard about the Dalton matters in 1996.
Oh, yes.
And then next spring, there was a little boat came up from St. Michael's, and we went on up to the 40 mile.
Oh, yes.
And stayed there. You could rock in the bars there and make from $5 to $20 a day there in the bars, rocking.
In the 40-mile.
Yeah, in the 40-mile. It was a good country then.
Then you moved on to Dawson?
Then when Dawson was in the boom, we went up to Dawson. And I worked there for Stanley and Ward in El Dorado there one winter, and it was a low drift. So at that time, the drifts were low, only about 4 feet high. And next spring, there was a bunch of us fellas who were kind of all bent over from not getting a chance to straighten up. We had to go out to the shaft to straighten up.
You put in a lot of time working pretty hard over there.
Well, they did, yes. Yes, sure. I was building the fires, but you couldn't do nothing much. And it was all wood fires, you see.
How far out of Dawson were you working?
Well, it's about 14 or 15 miles up to the Forks.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, up in El Dorado.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you stay in that vicinity?
Well, I stayed there long, and then I went. We were prospecting. Three or four of us, half a dozen of us, was prospecting, trying to find something for ourselves, you see. And then when in 1902, well, before that, 1901, I got a hold of a quartz mine down the Yukon, and we were on 300 feet of a tunnel. In there, right opposite Van Beaver's Roadhouse. And I sold out to Chairman of the Bank of Commerce and T.G. Wilson and Dr. Barrett. And they had done a lot of work on it, and I don't know if they ever made a grade on it. Then Fairbanks, Wada, he came up.
Oh, I've heard of the Jap
The Jap.
Was he a miner?
No, no, no. He was a Barnett. Had a trading outfit and a little boat called the Stella, and he started up the Tannenaut to trade with the Indians at Salt Jacket. And he come up the slough instead of going around the main river, and he got stuck right here at the bar where Fairbanks is now. And Felix Pedro and Pete Wilson was out prospecting here on the creek. And they had struck a little gold, but nothing to speak of. Just a few colors. There was work in the left limit, and that never was very good.
Oh, no.
So he dumped his stuff off there, and then he sent Wado to Dawson's. And he told all kinds of stories in the Dawson Daily News about Dan McCarty being offered $75,000 for his claim, and old Peter refused $125,000. And, of course, everybody's so excited. Wanted to go to the stampede. And I and Dempsey Lewis and Louis DeWolf and Fred Hassler and myself we had four dog teams, and we went down to Steel Creek on the 40 Mile and loaded up there and went up the North Fork of the 40 Mile and down the good pasture to the Tanano. That's the time we met Billy Mitchell. Billy Mitchell on the North Fork of the 40 Mile. And he was out laying a direction where he could put a telegraph wire over to Valdez or in that direction.
He was just a lieutenant then, wasn't he?
He was just a young lieutenant, and a small man, too. He was a little young fellow.
What sort of a man was he?
He was one of the finest little fellows I ever met. And then we got down to the mouth of the good pasture. We broke trail. We had to break trail on snowshoes. And sometimes we would have to go ahead, a lot of us go ahead, and we would break a trail, and then the next day it would be froze, and we could go right over it. But sometimes we went through some deep snow, and we didn't do that. But we go down to the mouth of the good pasture, and along the good the Tanana, sometimes the river don't freeze. And there was a boat there, an Indian boat. And we had to cross all those dog teams and all this stuff and ourselves and everything else. And the boys that was with me, they never had much experience in a boat. And I told DeWolf, I says, well, I've got to have some help. Well, he said, I'm afraid to get in that. There's ice there. And they didn't want to go in, none of them, you know. And Billy Mitchell, he says, by God, he says, I'm a canoe man. And he jumps right in.
Yeah. Did he do all right?
Why, fine. He was. He understood canoeing all right. And we crossed the whole layout. And then he had a great big dog team, 14 dogs, big Malamutes. And then he went on down the Tanana to meet another lieutenant that was going to come up and meet him from Fort Gibbon. And, of course, we had big loads, and we was traveling slow. And that's the last we seen of him then, until 1903, and when they started to build the line down the good pasture. So then we went on to Fairbanks, and we didn't see a single soul from we left the mouth of good pasture till we got to Fairbanks. There wasn't a sign of a human being anywhere, no white men at all, or very few Indians.
I suppose you wanted to check up on Wada's story right away.
Well, we went down there, and when we got to Fairbanks here, there was just a few people there, and Barnett had built a great big log cabin and all his goods in it. And George Noble was building a cabin. He had went down to Rampart and hauled a load of whiskey up there and was going to open a saloon. And he had the cabin almost completed.
Where was Barnett's first cabin located now?
It was right along where the NC Company is, someplace there. I think the NC Company afterwards, or Barnett gave the NC Company an awful good deal on that, because at Chenal, they thought Chenal was going to be the town. That is the head of navigation in the Tanana, you see. But finally, they got up here, the slough, with the steamboats, and that settled Chenal. It didn't amount to nothing.
I see.
And so then, of course, we went out on the creeks to investigate the thing, and they had really nothing. There were seven holes sunk on Clary Creek. An old fellow by the name of Pete Ling was working there, and they didn't have anything. Just a few colors was all. They were still prospecting. And then the following fall, the fall of 1903, Al Hilty struck it on Clary, 15 feet of pay, averaging about 10 cents to the pan, and then everything went booming up. And then they started to strike it on Fairbanks Creek and all the other places all around.
And then it really began to open up.
Yes, it opened up then, yeah.
Didn't they try to organize a necktie party for
Well, we went out in the creeks and we stayed out there about a month, a little over a month, and investigated the whole thing, and there was nothing there much. And when we come back in, there was 400 or 500 people here. And they were awful sore about the reports that come out from here about the big strike. Mm-hmm. And so they was going to hang the Jap. They held a meeting there. And Harry Badger here, he lives right over here. He's called the Berry King of the Tamno Valley, Strawberry King. Well, he was chairman of the meeting. But it didn't amount to anything. Nobody wanted to hang him anyhow, but it was a kind of a bluff, and that passed off. So then, it was getting late in the spring, and we started back. We were going back up the Yukon and Dawson, 40 miles. And we started by Circle City. We didn't go the way we come down. We come down the good pasture, and we were going around to Circle City and up the Yukon. And we met Judge Wickersham at Circle City. He was coming in here to name Fairbanks and start the lay at the going, you know. And his brother, Ed, was marshal. And when I went out there, I had quite a little experience with fur in the Hudson Bay Company, and I thought I'd knock around the Indian camp and buy some fur. And I went out to Sucker Creek, Black River, and down the Porcupine to Fort Yukon, and I bought about pretty near 300 marten.
But you've made your central location right around here, Fairbanks, ever since, haven't you?
Well, then, yes. Mm-hmm. I come down in 1904, mm-hmm. and took a lay on number 6 below on Fairbanks Creek.
And you're living out at Richardson now.
Well, then, Tenderfoot at Richardson was struck in 1905, mm-hmm. and I went to that stampede. And, of course, been there around there since. I got interested in claims and one thing and another, and been up there ever since. That's headquarters there.
I see.
Yeah.
We've certainly enjoyed this opportunity to talk with you for 15 minutes about the old days, Mr. Doherty.
Yeah.
Friends, we've listened to another interview on the presentation, Here's the Pioneer. And this week's genuine old-timer has been Mr. Pat Doherty of Richardson, Alaska. Here's a Pioneer, you know, is brought to you by Joe Coble and the Pioneer Cab Company, yes, each Wednesday evening at 7:30. We remind you again that their telephone number is East 10A, and they're located across from the Nordale Hotel. A Wednesday evening at 7:30 is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's another interview with one of Alaska's genuine old-timers, brought to you by Joe Coble and the staff of the Pioneer Cab Company. They're located, you know, across from the Nordale Hotel, and the telephone number, 24 hours a day, is East 10A. And the Pioneer visitor to the studios for this week is Mr. J.S. McKinnon. Mr. McKinnon, I have had as guests on Here's a Pioneer, for the most part, Fairbanks residents, but I believe that you hail from elsewhere in the territory. Where would that be?
That's right, Juneau.
You're a Juneau man. Have you spent very much time around this locality in interior Alaska?
4 years, 1905 to 1909 on the creeks, mm-hmm. Clary Creek, Vault Creek.
Well, to get the ball rolling on these interviews, it's customary to ask, where was your home down in the States?
Well, that's easily answered. I had no home.
I was waiting for that. Then apparently you were born in the territory of Alaska.
Correct.
What year was that?
97.
1897. That puts you in the territory before many of the sourdough pioneers who came up principally in 98 and 99. Well, what was your hometown in Juneau? Where were you born?
Juneau.
You were born in Juneau. Now, that name McKinnon, I seem to associate that with a lot of people I know in the territory and also in Canada. Is a fact that the McKinnons are all related, or is it a number of different families?
No, the woods are full of them, I'll admit that, but They are different families. We're not related.
I suppose every time you meet a McKinnon, well, then you have to sit down and figure out, the two of you, whether or not you are related.
Mm-hmm. Look up the family tree.
Yes. Speaking of the family tree, and the fact that your name McKinnon is well known up here, was your father also well known in the territory?
Dad was quite well known, Lockie McKinnon.
Lockie McKinnon.
That's right.
Didn't you tell me that one time a letter was addressed to him, Lockie McKinnon, Alaska, and it got there?
That's right.
Well, he certainly must have been well known. I wonder if you visited the area around here, which was formerly your home.
No, I intend to. Yes, I've been out to Clary, but I couldn't recognize any of the landmarks there. Mm-hmm. And Sunday, I looked up Art Lutrow, another old-timer, and we were going to try and find the old cabin out on Vault Creek.
Uh-huh. Were you successful? You haven't gone out yet.
We have not gone out yet, no.
I see. You say at Clary you couldn't find any trace. I suppose only tailing piles and brush.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Have the dredges gone through the section where the town of Clary used to be?
Apparently they've gone right through the old town site.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned that you lived at Clary for just about 4 years. Where did you go after you moved from Clary?
Well, I was then 12 years old and really hadn't gone to school, though we had a small school out there for a couple of winters.
Not very much in the way of formal education, though.
No, after 2 years, I was still in the second grade.
You know, Mr. McKinnon, it strikes me that some of the pioneers we've had on this program previously may have been your schoolmates. How about that?
Very possible. Elmer Nordell.
Yes, we've had him.
Well, he was my next-door neighbor, and I think the rest of them are probably out of the territory.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't even remember their names.
Pretty well spread around. Well, will you trace the course of your education after you left Clary Creek, please?
Well, grammar school in Seattle. Then I came back to Juneau, went to high school there, then Jim Wickersham appointed me to the Naval Academy in 1916.
How long were you in the Naval Academy?
Well, I was graduated from there in 1920.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I remained in the service until 1926, then resigned, came back to Juneau to live.
I see. What sort of work did you do when you returned to Juneau?
I have a laundry down there.
Oh, I see. You're still operating a laundry business in Juneau.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What kind of work did you do with the Navy during the past war? I understand you were called back into service.
Well, someone got the idea I knew a little something about Alaska.
I should think you would after all those years up here in the territory.
Well, then I was with Captain Parker when we were doing, that was in the planning stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was actually ordered from Juneau. I was the liaison officer, naval liaison officer to General Buckner. And then when we began to move west, I was the administrative commander for this is the fancy Navy titles, Commander Alaska. I was administrative commander, Commander Alaska Sector.
I see. That's the address on the letters then. Mm-hmm. And how long did you say you were in service in the Second World War?
Roughly 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And when did you come back into civilian uniform?
Just a little over a year ago.
Just a little over a year ago, yep. And then you returned to your home in Juneau.
That's right.
Uh-huh. I'm wondering how things are going down in Juneau right now. What is the outlook for the present and also the future in regard to local industry there?
Well, we're all very hopeful that the pulp industry will move in. There was a recent transaction in Juneau. An outside firm bought the sawmill, mm-hmm. and expect to expand. I understand they will have two shifts on.
I see.
Just depending on the amount of logs they can get for cutting.
That is for the lumber industry. Now, about pulp and paper, I understand that Ketchikan is far more concerned with that kind of a future than Juneau. Are there any pulp or
pulp timber stands right near Juneau?
I think the whole area would really be suitable for pulp.
It seems likely, then, that they might put a pulp mill in Juneau just as well as they would in Ketchikan.
That's right. We have a lot of power that may be developed.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. McKinnon, I'm sure that many of our listeners are interested in the reason for your being here in Fairbanks right now.
Well, I came up to see my son graduate out here at the college.
I see. Is he your only son?
Only son.
Mm-hmm. And what did he major in at college?
Chemistry.
Chemistry. And what are his plans for the future?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to convince him that he ought to come down and run the laundry while I play.
I see. What kind of playing do you imagine you do? Do you intend to do some traveling? I suppose you've been tied down quite a lot.
I have been tied down very much. Mm-hmm. In fact, during the war, I never did have any leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had expected to take a vacation, which I have not taken as yet.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. McKinnon, we certainly appreciate your visiting with us here in the studios. You know, it's not very often that we have a pioneer visitor coming up from southeastern Alaska. Now, we have a bit of time remaining, and if you have any kind of a message for the hundreds of friends that I feel confident you have in our listening audience, now certainly would be your time to say it. Any particular comment for those that you may remember from the old days?
No, I don't think there is. They say hello, that's all.
Do you find that Fairbanks has changed a great deal
quite a
in
bit,
the last few
quite
years?
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm. See, I had occasion several times to come up here during the war, so the change was not altogether a surprise.
I feel sure that there's going to be plenty of change in the next 2 or 3 years, so the next time you return to the interior city, you're going to see a very definite transformation.
I can see that now.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. McKinnon. Friends, you've listened to an interview with Mr. J.S. McKinnon. The program has been Here's a Pioneer, a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel. And once again, we remind you that the number is East 10A. Be with us next Wednesday evening at 7:30 for Here's a Pioneer.